the best ideas and our greatest insights come when we create sufficient time to think and reflect. And I use in the example, tons of examples in the book, whether it's General Petraeus and General Mattis creating and structuring 7 or 8 months in the pre-time before the surge in which to quote-unquote reflect and to think about the lessons learned of counterinsurgency and to understand how to become a learning organization, which was really what was at the heart of that. And so that had to do with the war kept going, and to your point, the speed and the immediacy of war is nonstop. But the best ideas and the new insights came from giving respect and creating the space in which to think. And likewise, not just when you create the space, I think there's also a lot that I talk about in the book of how leaders must feel compelled today to really go and give some intellectual white space to the downside. And all too often, Chris, I think, you know, in the real-time flow of now, we sometimes sort of acquiesce to the immediate. We say, well, that sounds like a decent approach, and if it's reasonably well thought out, you know, we're going to go for it. I think the great lessons of the financial downturn and others is that there wasn't a systematic way to think through the downside of the world. And so I spent time thinking about and giving readers techniques in which to explore the downside, because I think it's more than just keeping up with email. I think it's to your point, I think there's a richness to at least elevating time to think from beyond the 5 to 10% of our days that we're doing according to firms like Basics today.
One of the things you talk about in one of my favorite sections was it's called taking a step back from abusing email to exceptional organizations. And one of the things that I think we've done is we've taken email and we use it as this tool, and we use it regardless of what situation we face, whether we need a screw or a hammer or whatever. We use email as this device. And so we're all, and you talk to anybody, they feel deluged by this email monster out there. And part of what you talk about is you need to figure out ways that you can, part of this is using the right tool in the right circumstance.
That's correct. I mean, the email deluge, one of the firms that I studied was a company called PBD out of Atlanta. And one of the exercises that they did was, and they've implemented it and kept to this, by the way, was they wondered if just on a single day a week, on Friday of every week, could inside the organization, between their peers, could they move towards no email with one another and move towards more richer context, e.g. getting on the phone with people, face-to-face meetings, etc. And while that experiment, as I write about in the book, sort of took a little bit of a downturn in the early part because everyone sort of queued up their email messages for the day, 4 years later, what that firm has done, and Scott Doctor, who I'm still in touch with there, has done, is that they've taken a systematic view of the emails that they exchange with one another. And they asked themselves, well, how much of what is going between one another is really urgent and necessary? Because I think what we have with email is an example where individual knowledge workers kind of self-direct, and they are able to then say, well, this is my level of importance, and therefore everyone has to respond. Mm. When you do that times tens of thousands of employees in an organization, you're going to wind up with a very inconsistent and fractured way in which to think about not only the issue that's represented in the email, but the problems that are being solved by the firm. So what I love that what PBD was they figured out, could they wrestle back time? Because so much of their narrative had become just simple email responses. And we all know, I think, that no organization or the mission of any organization is living just email responsiveness. I think we've got to do better than that. So I called that chapter Taking a Big Step Back, because my biggest question is, can you even question the hierarchy of communications? Because the default today has become email and instant. And there's nothing wrong with that. And some decisions must be made in an instant. But my argument is that many of them don't. And the only way that you can do that is to take a systematic step back and to question the whole hierarchy and therefore the tempo. And also, by the way, our use, our habits before the technology. Technology is great, by the way, but it's our habits that I'm asking and questioning the most about.
We're talking to Daniel Patrick Forrester. He is the author of the book, Consider, Harnessing the Power of Reflective Thinking in Your Organization. And it is the brand new Dorabeck Insider Book Club book. We will be discussing this in much more detail on April 15th, right here on the Big Show. Really looking forward to that. When you were out doing both research for this and talking to people, because I can tell you, just we're talking to a lot of folks as you were pulling this together. Did people have similar reactions to? I mean, they you see people and they're and how they clutch to their devices or to the speed. You ask everybody, they say, oh, I'm so busy. If you say, you know, if you talk about taking a little time out, it's almost like they look at you and give you this look like you're from planet Mars.
And I think that's right. I mean, I got a lot of different responses from people. But I also had a lot of leaders, such as General Mattis, who just really, you know, he does not extol necessarily the virtues of the immediacy. I mean, he called the lack of time for reflection one of the single greatest deficits facing mature military thinkers and leaders today. In other words, we're devaluing the thing that makes us most unique. And Chris, the language that I use to describe this world of busyness, and I also called it the responsiveness narrative, I think that what I'm really doing is it sounds almost countercultural. You know, this guy is actually questioning the way that we're all sort of habitually hooked up. And the answer is yes. Because when you realize what's happening to the knowledge workers day and how we're fragmenting it and how 5 to 10% of our time is spent thinking and reflecting, yet 30% of our days are spent responding to things that are not immediate and urgent, 30%, yeah. You have to ask yourself, am I really productive? Am I really contributing to the mission the way that I could? Am I focusing what little time that I have on giving time to think and to deeply to pull through issues, or am I simply coping? So I think that there is something countercultural about what I'm talking about, but in the end, I think we've got to come up with a new norm of how to do this, because I think the long-term implications of extending people into these extended work hour cultures in which we're on all the time, I think creates people who are tired. I don't know that you hatch, by the way, new and great ideas when you are trying to stretch the workday into
right.
12, 15, 20 hours
yeah.
a day. And it's just impossible to think about what Petraeus referred to me and told me about as the next big idea. And he said those don't fall from a tree like an apple on Newton's head. They have to be nourished over time. So my question to leaders is, if not now, when will you nurture the next big idea that will make sure that your organization is relevant moving forward in this big tumultuous century?
And yet I found when I was reading the book almost like, oh my goodness, I'm going to be left behind. We talked about this a little bit, but there's that real fear, you see, I mean, again, how people are so attached to their devices or whatever, they have to answer within seconds. And there's, I think it is almost that fear that the world's moving so fast, if I'm not up on every second, that I'm going to be I'm not a player. I'm not part of, you know, I'm better, you know, I'm seen and not heard.
Yeah, I think there is a real fear factor, and I think that leaders today have to manage that fear. And I think, by the way, Chris, it starts with top down.
Well, and that's where I wanted to go next, because it does seem leadership, if this doesn't start, I mean, you mentioned the organization that does no email Fridays,
yeah.
That has to start from the top, doesn't it?
I was convinced at the end of this book that if you have leaders that simply think that this premise that I'm talking about is nonsensical, in other words, that immediacy is their only tool in their toolbox, then there's no chance they're going to connect with any of the content in the book. But if there's a real leader that sits there and says, my goodness, I'm just looking at how do I spend my day? How much of my time do I spend marinating in big ideas in which I create safe space? And I talk a lot about Google and Whirlpool and organizations that have carved out the time with a real structure, by the way. You can't just have think time and people going to sit up on the rock and pondering the big questions.
Yeah.
Think time has to be structured, because otherwise self-directed, I think you're going to wind up instantly going back to Google and going back to the other habits that sort of form. But it does take courage. And once the courage sort of, you know, comes on the scene, I think you're going to wind up, Chris, with a leader who's going to show a little bit more control, a different battle rhythm and a tempo. And otherwise, the tempo is going to be immediacy. And I think this is the big crux of the distinctions that's going to be made as we move forward in the next decade, is which are the leadership teams that even have the language that I define in the book to create the space and the time to think, or those that sit there and say, I'll just get by on immediacy.
And
I think the latter is going to be a really disastrous choice over time.
And part of the, and you just mentioned it, part of the big change in my mindset that came out of this book was the tool that we've used, the thing that we use to differentiate ourselves from anybody else is speed. But there are other aspects of this, making a better product, whatever that means, better services, whatever that is, doing something in other ways, being more innovative, coming up with whatever. So many of us focus purely on being first to market or whatever else, being first. Speed is the thing, and that's not always the thing that ends up lasting, living past this year, this month.
I think that's right. I mean, you know, if big ideas take time, right? So go back to what Petraeus said, and you think about the great innovations and the great new things that come on the field. You know, we all extol and look at in awe companies like Apple. I'd argue that there's a ton of reflection happening inside that firm, and they're hatching big ideas and nurturing them inside very safe spaces right now, and that will come out over time. In other words, it's not going to be tomorrow that the next innovation comes, but it's probably going to be 6 to 8 months, maybe a year, in which I promise you, Mr. Jobs is going to get up on a stage and offer the world something new to think about.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen through serendipity. That happens through paying attention and giving time and the safe space in which, you know, by the way, some of the things and the ideas may go nowhere. But inside our government particularly, and I've written about this in the past when I've written about change agents, the people who have the best concepts, I call them, back in the day, I call them conceptualizers, the dogged conceptualizers. It takes a long time to gather a big idea, nurture it, particularly in an interagency environment. And that, by the way, can't be hatched in the immediacy of now. You can't fracture that and do that through 1,000 emails and say that I'm going to take a big idea that's going to rip across 10 agencies and field it. So I think, you know, the leaders have a big, big choice to make at the end of this. In every chapter that I wrote, I tried to punch this, which that you can sit there and rationalize it away and say, this just, the world is too fast and I don't have time for it. But the evidence is actually on my side that our greatest moments, our best insights, the new product, the new service, or the evolution of a mission comes when we create some of the space in which to think and reflect and give people incentives to do it versus just having the immediacy narrative. And it's going to be a great discussion with you to see if people truly connect with it, because I think there's those that can deny the data that I present in the book and rationalize away, and there's others that will sit there and say, I think this is a song I've been waiting to hear for a long time.
Well, and I think there's, particularly in this time of do more with less, there's a lot of, this book speaks to a lot of that, because people are going to be asked, you're going to have a lot more things pulling and eating into that white space. And so really justifying it, making sure there's a return on that, it becomes even more important.
I think that's right. I mean, I go back to one of the pieces of think time has to have a level of accountability. And if you use the examples that I talked about in the book, Whirlpool, for example, Whirlpool, most people would not necessarily think of being as one of the most innovative companies. I'd argue that they have astounded me the more that I've studied them. Razor thin margins, facing a very deep economic recession. But what's really interesting is about how they created a culture of not just nurturing big ideas, but they have very distinct quality gates in which their think time goes through. On the upfront side, is it a big addressable market? Does this have a chance to become something that could be cash flow positive to their business within a short period of time? And their executive team, by the way, is constantly looking in on the innovation teams. They have thousands of them, Chris, that have been stood up around this company, 78,000 employees. They have thousands of small sort of mini innovation teams that are not self-directed. They're all directed within a common architecture. And to your point, I think as resources become more scarce and you have to do more with less people, I think those who go short and continue to not pay attention to nurturing the big ideas, you're going to wake up one day and question the overall relevancy of the organization and what it means in the marketplace, and that's not a good place to be.